Well, Bill, how do you answer the question when people say, well, if we don't pay income tax, what would support the country we live in?
The federal government, right now, as I'm speaking, has $37 trillion in surplus money. And I have those books at home. The state of Illinois has $4.8 trillion in surplus money. Now, how do you get surplus money? By overtaxing. Stop the taxing. $37.7 trillion? Good Lord, the interest on that money will keep this government going from now until doomsday.
And isn't it true the IRS costs so much money just to keep it running? Basically, they're a collection agency. Is that correct? A collection agency for the Federal Reserve to collect taxes. But the cost just for the IRS alone is costing taxpayers tremendous amounts of their tax dollars. Is that correct?
Just for them to open the doors. It costs them billions of dollars to just open the doors without collecting anything. President Reagan had a man by the name of J. Peter Grace do a study on the waste and abuse in federal government. If you remember the $600 toilet seats, the $400 hammers, well, it was J. Peter Grace that uncovered all that. J. Peter Grace had the authority to go into anyone's desk, anyone's office, with the exception of the IRS. He couldn't go there and see where the waste and abuse was. And he wrote a 8-page letter to President Reagan and told him in that letter that not one nickel of the personal income tax goes to support any of the agencies of federal government or anything that federal government does. It goes for nothing but to reduce the interest on the national debt.
Isn't it true? A lot of people are thinking, what about the roads we drive on, the schools our children go to? Isn't it the personal tax and the sales tax and the excise tax that pays for those things?
That's exactly correct. There's a lot of people that simply don't understand the taxing authority, how it works, who builds the roads. And of course, federal government does. They help. But it comes from your gasoline tax. When you go to the gasoline station and start to pump gasoline in your car, you don't have to sign under the penalty of perjury, but you're still paying a sales tax. You're paying an excise tax. And I believe that's the thing that Congress is trying to implement now is an excise tax. I don't believe they'll get away with it, but that's what they're trying to do.
And Bill, isn't it true here you are openly confessing you do not pay personal income tax, yet what do you receive every month from the government?
I'm 75 years old, and I do receive a Social Security check. There isn't any question about that. I don't feel guilty about taking it because I worked for that money. I mean, that was money that I paid into, even though the federal government paid into it too. There's a lot of people that will say, well, I'm going to rescind my Social Security. I'm going to rescind this, rescind that. Some people at 64, 65 years old, they want to go ahead and rescind their Social Security when they have this money coming to them. It's your money. Take it.
From here on in, if you could write the resolution, the end of the movie, the way you'd like to see it go, what would it look like?
I believe that the end of the movie would be we would have a country that would prosper and grow so quickly overnight, it would be absolutely unbelievable. You would have peace and harmony in this country because the big battles in this country are with the IRS. I mean, the IRS is a gangster government, and I have no qualms about calling them a bunch of gangsters because that's what they are, because I have documents from jail that show that the IRS agents steal money. One agent in Washington stole $569,000 in one check. That check legally belonged to a taxpayer. And he made sure that the check went to his home, so he was able to cash it. And when he did, and when his paperwork started to come back through the IRS, he got rid of all the paperwork. And it was a lady in Chicago that it took them 10 years to catch up to her. She had stolen $269,000. that's only the very, very tip of the iceberg. I mean, they're all involved.
What do you see unfolding in order to get to that prosperous country that you just described? What are the steps that would happen from where we are to the dissolution of the problem and the beginning of the new possibility?
There's going to have to be a meeting of the minds with the people like me that are fighting this issue, with people like the IRS agents that have resigned. There has to be a meeting of the minds with the Congress of the United States and with the Department of Justice and the IRS. You have to have a common road someplace. We have to have a starting place. And we've tried to do that in Washington. 8 times we've been in Washington, and 8 times we have been ignored. But believe me, we're going to be back there a 9th time and a 10th time and 11th if we have to. In 1987, I sent to the entire Congress of the United States, Volume 1 and 2. First, I send the books back to my printer to have the congressman or congresswoman's name embossed on the bottom of the book like the book is outlined in gold, and had UPS hand deliver it to each and every member of Congress. And I got a lot of letters back, a lot of favorable letters back. I sent Volume 1 and 2 to 1,158 judges in this country, the United States attorneys, from the president all the way down. I sent them Volume 1 and 2. Last year, there were 60 million people that refused to file a tax return. I'm waiting for the figure to come out for this year. I'll bet you it's well over 100 million. Without a question of a doubt.
So the educational effort has been and is being quite successful.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
So it's really just a matter of time.
It's a matter of time. It's a matter of time to where a group of congressmen or a group of senators will say, okay, enough is enough. How much more do we have to fight?
At this stage in the process, what support can further the results that we all want to see?
I think that by writing letters to Congress, by saying to the Internal Revenue Service, no. What part of no don't you understand? Even though the courts have decided they don't want to listen to it, you can't keep something like this under wraps. They've done it for 80 years. It's out in the open now. So you might as well go ahead and concede. Someone's going to have to concede. I think the thing that they're really waiting for is for me to pass on. But with the people that are coming aboard now, like IRS agents, that to me is a credit. I feel very pleased about that. So if anything happens to me, the IRS agents or any number of people can go ahead and take up this fight right now. Because the 17,000 documents are still going to be available. I have 4 children, and they are all very well aware of what Father does all the time. They are behind him 100%. I have a 10-year-old granddaughter who has been graded in the 3rd and 4th grade as the smartest 3rd and 4th grader in the state of Michigan, and they want to skip her several grades. And so far, we haven't let her do that. Northwest University is testing Brittany. And Brittany is reading Volume 1 and 2 and asking me a lot of questions about it. So here we have a 10-year-old that will take this fight up.
Now, Bill, you talked about the gold seal and the blue ribbon. Can you explain what process each of these documents has to go through?
Yes. To begin with, the Congress of the United States, when they want the states to ratify an amendment, they have to send a certified, notarized document to the governor of the state. The governor will then call the General Assembly into session, and then the governor will tell them and read to them, and then they are asked to accept or reject. No more, no less. In the 16-page memorandum that I found in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. It said, further, under the provision of the Constitution, a legislator is not authorized to alter in any way the amendment as proposed by Congress. So when I would go to a state to get a document certified and notarized, I have to get the documents from whatever journal I'm looking at. I have to peg the pages and then take it to the Secretary of State's office. And then they put the blue ribbon, the gold seal, like on the Kentucky document. If I were to go ahead and make an attempt to just copy the documents myself or anyone, you cannot do it. It's not legal. The Secretary of State must do it from the peg pages that you have.
So that helps me understand why he's called the Secretary of State. Because it's a secretarial job in this case.
Right.
Make a copy of this, please.
Now, Bill, how do you answer questions? You have spent some time in prison, and people are coming to conclusions that you spent time in prison because of not paying taxes based on the 16th Amendment argument. Can you explain your story about going to prison?
Of course. To begin with, the 16th Amendment issue was not argued at the district level in my case. If you'll remember, I told you that if you take the documentation into court, and we did that, we brought 17,000 certified notarized documents, 17,000 for the judge, 17,000 for the prosecutor, and we had a big dolly to wheel all those boxes up into the courtroom. The documentation that I brought into court in my case, when the government indicted me for the year of 1980 and 1981, because they said that I had worked for an insurance company and I had received $110,000 from that insurance company. Well, that was a settlement from the insurance company, like I won my case before the Department of Revenue, because the insurance company did not represent me as an agent in 8 cases. We had 8 pending cases where my partner and I made the arrest. And because I blew the whistle on the Department of Revenue, they would not represent me. So I had to go out and hire an attorney and do most of the work myself to begin with. And the insurance company wound up paying me $110,000 as a settlement. The insurance agent went to the grand jury and testified that I worked for his company, that the $110,000 was income. And when we got him on the witness stand, my attorney said, we have asked you to bring all of his records from your company. We want to know how much vacation time he has coming. We want to see his personnel record. Where is it at? And the attorney said, need I ask the question back or should I have the court reporter read it back? So he raised his head and he says, no, I lied when I testified before the grand jury. And that's in the transcript. There isn't any way anyone can get by that. The judge, after hearing that, ushered the jury out of the room immediately. We had about a 4 to 5 hour battle then with the government and with the jury. And the judge says, well, this case is going to go ahead anyhow. Maybe he lied and maybe he didn't. And there wasn't any way that we were going to change that judge's mind. After a 5.5 week jury trial, the jury found me guilty on that $110,000. I spent 15 months and 5 days in prison at FMC Rochester in Minnesota. And I take medication, since the 1960s, because I was infected with encephalitis. When I got into the institution, they put me in the hospital section. And I said, what am I doing here? Why not general population? They said, no, this is where you're going to stay. So they took my medication away, and I said, you can't do that, because if you do, I'm going to have problems. I'm going to have seizure problems. And they said, we're going to change your medication. We're going to give you what we think is best for you. I said, no, you're not. But I had four guards that came in, one on each leg, one on each arm, and three nurses, two across my midsection and one with the needle. And that was La La Land. Believe me, that was La La Land. I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, I couldn't talk, I couldn't walk. That put me in a wheelchair for 2 years. My prison time, I guess, went by quickly because I didn't know anything for a long time. Mrs. Benson got a telephone call from one of the inmates and said, you better get into this institution because we believe they're trying to kill Bill. So she did. I was only there 6 days. And the warden wasn't going to let her see me. And she put up a big battle with the warden. And finally, there were two nurses that had to wheel me down from the hospital. Now I was covered with bed sheets. My body had swollen up with edema, probably three times the size as it is right now. Our daughter then was 38 years old. I didn't know her. I couldn't see her and talk to them. No. What she did was get on the telephone when she got back home. A lot of people formed what they call a telephone tree and blocked all of the telephone lines coming into the prison because people would be calling the prison every minute, you know, so no lines, nobody could get in or out. And then they started to write to the Congress. They said, what are you trying to do, kill Bill Benson because he authored a couple books on the 16th Amendment? After they had received in excess of 100 letters from members of Congress, they then decided, after one congressman said, what do we have to do? Send in an investigating team in there to find out what you're doing with that man. Then they finally stopped the overmedication. They put me back on the same medication I came in the hospital on, but the damage was done. They had to wheel me wherever I went. I couldn't move the wheels on the wheelchair. It was about 9 months before I really started to come to. The inmates, there were three of them that said, we're going to bring you out of this. And of course, they told me that later because I didn't understand what they were doing. They used to hold cards in my hand. You can see it. You can see it. You can do it. Every day, as many hours as they could do. And then it would take me up to the gym and have me hold dumbbells if I couldn't hold them. Little by little by little, it was the inmates that brought me back. And when I did come back, I thought, wait a minute, I'm in a wheelchair, and I can't get to one of my favorite places, and that's a library, because it's on the fourth floor. I was very familiar with the Uniform Standard Accessibility Act enacted by Congress. I had a friend of mine on the outside. I said, John, send me the books. And I got two sets of them. And I took them to the warden. And I said, I want to get to the library. And I'm going to get to the library because the Uniform Standard Accessibility Act says I can go anywhere that anyone else can go in this institution, even though I am a federal prisoner. So now what you have to do is you have to build ramps from the bottom floor up to the fourth floor. The inmates named those ramps the Benson Drives. Then it was one thing after the other after the other. It was the Italian people like to play bocce ball. And they said, well, Bill, how about getting this done for us, getting new bocce ball courts for us? I said, well, I'll give it a try. So I went to the warden and I said, I can't play bocce ball with this wheelchair. I want you to build bocce ball courts for handicapped people. And he built three. And I said, by the way, fix the others for the other inmates so you don't have a complaint from them. See, my mind is starting to gel now. The legal aspect of me is coming back. And I said, wait a minute. FOIA says that I can have the name and the address and the grade of pay and the salary of every employee in this institution. And I want it. So when I went to the office to get it, they said, we're not giving you that. I said, if you don't give it to me, then you might as well take a bed next to mine, because now you become a criminal. It took about a month and a half, and I got a stack of papers, 3/4 of a foot tall, with the name, the address, the grade of pay, and everything about the employees. One sergeant came up to me and he says, "What the hell do you care how much money I make?" I said, "Well, quite frankly, I really don't. I don't think I've even read it yet because I can't quite see enough to read it yet." So it was making the law work for you on the inside. The law still works for inmates on the inside as well as it does on the outside when they put you in there. There are things that they can do to you and things that they cannot do. And if you know a little bit about the law, there's a whole lot that you can get done. So at least I made my mark in that institution. There was about 5 inmates that went to the warden when I was leaving and said, "We would like Bill to come back and visit us." He says, "I never want to see that man in this prison again." And the reason I was leaving is because the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals had said that Judge Paul Plunkett had abused his discretion in permitting the testimony to go on the way he did by the IRS agents, that they had tainted the minds of the jurors, and the government's case was weak at its best. And the chief and key witnesses for the government, their testimony was open to a very serious question. "We must reverse Benson," period. And out I came. That really hurt federal government. They didn't like that. Because now I'm out, now I'm talking about 16th Amendment again. So I learned a great deal. And I think that I helped a lot of people in that institution. It was an education for me, winding up in prison because you authored a couple of books, mostly because you beat the state out of a big lawsuit, and they didn't like that.
So, Bill, are you saying that your case was reversed?
My case was reversed, absolutely reversed, yes.
Bill, in terms of that case being reversed, has that in any way helped anyone else coming after you to keep them out of that trouble? The fact that you went ahead and dealt with it and worked it through and reversed it.
I think it does help when I go to the IRS office, yeah, because they know who I am. There aren't any question about it. Now, when I can bring a former IRS agent in with me, and I've done that in a couple cases, yeah, they don't like that either. And so they'll leave the individual alone.
But when a case is reversed, does it stay on the books? Is it something that other attorneys can refer to or use as a precedent?
Oh,
or
does
it
just disappear? Sure, it's reversed, yeah.
So it's there and reversed, and that stands
and reversed,
as the record.
Yeah. One of the things that happened during the course of my trial is that the court said, "What about Mr. Dickstein's statement that there was language in the case that says this question of the 16th Amendment has not been developed? We don't have a record on it, and I refuse to allow him to create a record on it. What about that issue?" Mr. Stone, who was the prosecutor, "Well, the 16th Amendment issue wasn't adjudicated in this case because it wasn't a proper defense. It had nothing whatsoever to do with why taxes weren't paid in 1980 and 1981. Mr. Benson, by his own testimony, his remarks again today, said his research began in 1984 and he wrote his book in 1985. And he even says, if you can believe him, he went into it with an open mind." And then the court says, "But that's not the point. The point is, if his thesis is correct, there was no law to violate." The judge also makes several other interesting comments. He says, "I believe that his book, The Law That Never Was, which I have read," that puts that judge on a witness stand in any case, "is the work of a man who investigated the 16th Amendment and came to certain conclusions about it and wrote a book about it. And I do not consider that in this case as any mark against Mr. Benson. If it's not a mark against me, it's not a mark against anyone. I am ignoring that to the extent that it's somehow supposed to reflect badly on him. In fact, I think if it does anything, it makes an argument for him. Once again, if it makes an argument for me, it makes an argument for everyone. Because free speech in this country is protected. And when the day arrives when it isn't, we will not have a United States of America, at least as we know it. He is a person who has convictions and believes in them and speaks out about them. And I hope the day doesn't come when we punish people for doing that." And right after saying that, that hypocrite put me in prison for 4 years.
You actually read that from a court transcript.
That is a transcript, yeah. What the judge really meant and what he said when he said that was he knew that we were dealing with an issue of fraud. And if there is no law to violate for me, there is no law to violate for anyone. And this is part of the documentation that I read when I go into the IRS and present a case with a potential defendant.
It's very exciting. And we'd like to thank you for the amazing work that you've done in bringing this to light so that we can all carry it forward with you.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.
For additional information on this topic, go to your online resource center at www.pqionline.cc. Click on Products and Solutions and go to Disc Number 3.